I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 128. That's 2 to the power of 7, if you're interested, of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. Listen to us every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time, here on prn.fm, or download us after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast program. You can also listen to any of the last 5 episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. phone number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. Malcolm Kendrick is a GP living in Macclesfield, the United Kingdom. He graduated in medicine from Aberdeen University and trained as a GP in Scotland. He set up an online education system for the European Society of Cardiology and the first website for the National Institute for Clinical Excellence. He's a member of the Center for Evidence-Based Medicine in Oxford and of the International Network of Cholesterol Skeptics. He's published on cardiovascular disease in the British Medical Journal, Medical Hypotheses, Pulse, and Pharmacoeconomics. He is very concerned about the medical establishment, the what he calls strident healthcare lobby, scaring us about everything we do, from eating bacon and eggs to drinking coffee to alcohol to getting a suntan. He's the author of the book Doctoring Data, How to Sort Out Medical Advice from Medical Nonsense, and The Great Cholesterol Con, The Truth About What Really Causes Heart Disease and How to Avoid It. His website is drmalcolmkendrick.org. And I'll put it in the show notes if you have trouble spelling it. Welcome to the show, Dr. Kendrick.
Welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
Yes. So did you always think outside the box that medical school builds for its budding doctors, or were you already chafing at the bit when you were studying medicine?
I think it's a bit of a combination. I think when you're younger, you tend to accept that what your grown-up, serious adult people are telling you is probably true, and that you tend to go along with the flow more, I think, at first, and it's only only slightly later on that you begin to look at things in more detail, and at times you think, hold on, I know I'm being told this, but frankly, it just doesn't add up, and it becomes a bit of a path, I suppose, that some people choose to look at and decide maybe not to go down.
Right. I mean, what are the pressures on doctors to conform?
Well, it's medicine's, I suppose all the professions, but I think medicine probably more than most is a highly conformist sort of, don't quite know what the word is. I do know when I started at medical school, the deputy dean had us all in a lecture theatre, and in truth, he did say, well, welcome to the brotherhood.
Sounds more like a cult.
Well, I think there is an element of feeling you are part of a definitely part of a kind of grouping of some sort that is whilst it's within society is kind of separated from it. I think most people are aware that doctors have a carry themselves in a certain way and act in certain ways and speak in certain ways, and it is a I wouldn't like to call it a cult because I don't think it's quite there, but it's maybe halfway to a cult, perhaps. But it definitely requires a great deal of I don't know if the right word is subservience, but it sometimes seems that way to the superiors. That depends from country to country. I've spoken to doctors from Germany where it is very much, you know, the senior doctors and the professors. You cannot argue with them. They tell you that is it, you know. I think in other countries it's not quite as much as that, but it's definitely, there is a sense that you are part of an organization in which there is a hierarchy, and going against the views of the hierarchy it's not going to be a great career move for you.
Well, I mean, there are cases of doctors who go too far outside the bounds of what the average person thinks, the average doctor thinks is reasonable, getting struck off the register for things that seem more like punishment than actually trying to save the world from a dangerous doctor.
Well, I think there can be. In fact, I just received an email from someone who's being, who I shall not name.
Yeah.
They're being a wee bit insulting to me, accusing me of something, and I just wrote back saying, well, actually, you haven't read what I've written. But he, in fact, is a great vitamin C advocate and thinks vitamin C will reverse heart disease. He's not actually a doctor, but he's in an optometry, and he was struck off for having these views. There are doctors in, there's a doctor, well, this is public knowledge, is Tim Noakes, Professor Tim Noakes in South Africa, who changed his mind from being very much a carbohydrate, and you must take carbohydrates, and he was an endurance athlete as well, so he was, in fact, invented various gels and things which were high in sugars for people to take, and has now completely reversed his opinion and believes that actually the high-fat, low-carbohydrate is the healthy option, and in fact is good for sport. And he was dragged in front of the South African courts to, you know, basically was told that he shouldn't be saying these things, and there's been a hearing. I don't know what the outcome is. So yes, if you there's certain areas, there's certain things you can say in medicine, but there's certain areas where you must tread quite lightly, and also just be very careful with what you say. Otherwise, you will be effectively, yes, you will be.
Attacked. All right. Do you have you heard about the case of Dr. Wayne Squire in the UK?
Oh, Dr. Wayne Squire. Yes, I mean that's to me, there's a terrible thing is that I mean she doesn't believe that shaken baby syndrome exists.
Right.
As you know,
she used to, and she changed her mind.
Sorry.
She used to. She testified for the prosecution.
And
then she changed her mind.
And then changed her mind and said, no, I don't believe the evidence exists to support the idea that this syndrome of you shake the baby and there's retinal hemorrhages and blah, blah, blah exists. And she got struck off about a year ago in the UK, although she's now had her further hearing and has been quashed. But basically, yes, people didn't like the fact that she was saying these things, and rather than have a scientific debate, it's like, well, shut up or we'll punish you. And you know, I'm acutely aware of the dangers of taking on you know, the conventional views in medicine, and I'm always very careful to do, although people sometimes think I'm not careful to do this, is I don't provide individual advice to people,
right,
you know, over the internet. I never say you should do this or you should do that, because that's when they can actually get you. It's when you provide advice,
right,
to a person. You can say, I think this is nonsense, and I think this idea is nonsense, and I think the whole thing is nonsense. So long as you keep that general, you're okay. Once you start saying, you, Mr. Smith, should be taking this, and you shouldn't be doing that, then you're treading a very fine line, and you're likely to get attacked for it. So,
yes.
So you have to be careful. Yes, you do.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your core, you know, maybe where you started with criticism, which is heart disease and, you know, the cholesterol theory first. So is eating cholesterol bad for you? Is it a risk for heart disease?
Well, no, it's not. And in fact, the latest American guidelines have come out basically saying you can eat as much cholesterol as you like because it's no longer a nutrient of concern, I think was the exact phrase that they used, which is interesting. But they're saying, well, we never said eating cholesterol was bad for you. It's eating saturated fat that's bad for you, because it's saturated fat that raises your cholesterol and causes you to die of heart disease. One of the biggest problems I have with the whole, what I tend to call it, the diet heart stroke cholesterol hypothesis,
right,
being that it's supposed to be you eat saturated fat undefined, your cholesterol level rises, and then you die of heart disease.
Right.
It's a two-stage process. I mean, when I first looked into this area, I wasn't questioning the cholesterol part of the hypothesis. I was questioning mainly the dietary part, because there was absolutely no evidence at all that I could see. But one of the problems you have is whenever you question this hypothesis, it changes in front of your very eyes.
Right.
So you can never actually get hold of it. In fact, I usually liken it to the Hydra, where you chop one head off and it just grows another two. So actually, every time you attack it, it just gets stronger, because it never stand still for long enough. So, you know,
on the other hand, like on the other side, is there a danger to not having cholesterol in your diet, or can you produce cholesterol from other things?
Well, your body will synthesize cholesterol. I mean, your body will synthesize five times, on average, about five times as much cholesterol as you would ever consume in your diet,
mm-hmm,
because your liver and your body knows cholesterol is a vital substance of which it must have a lot. So you could eat no cholesterol I don't quite know how you do that, but I presume you could.
Right.
If you're a strict vegan, you could eat no cholesterol, and your liver will synthesize cholesterol from other sources enough to you know, keep your body going. So you don't need to eat it. As far as I'm aware, there is no nutritional requirement for one molecule of cholesterol.
Right. I seem to remember when cholesterol was a big thing, and thinking about it, I haven't heard much about it recently, but eggs were the big bad thing, right?
Yeah, that's right. Well, eggs are, because egg yolks are obviously the nutrient for the growing egg, which grows from the whitey bit, the clear bit. The reason why they've got so much cholesterol, as I say to people, why do you think eggs contain so much cholesterol? I said, because it takes an enormous amount of cholesterol to build a healthy chicken, as it takes an enormous amount of cholesterol to build a healthy anything, any animal. We need vast amounts of it, and that's why the eggs contain vast amounts of it. So this idea that a substance that is absolutely essential for the development of the entire body of animals is a dangerous substance is so, you know, when you think of it, it's just so ridiculous as an idea. But that's just the case. That people.
I mean, is there any harm? I mean, if somebody says, well, I just want to be safe, so I won't eat eggs, like, is there harm to people doing things like that?
I think you could eat no eggs for all of your life. You could avoid cholesterol for all of your life. And as far as I'm aware of, there's an interesting book, I don't know if you've heard of it, called The Blue Zones, which looks at people who live longer than anyone else.
No.
Groups of people who live longer than anyone else in the world. And one of the groups is a vegetarian group, is actually the Californian in Palo Alto. They are not the Seventh-day Adventists, so they might be Seventh-day something. Anyway, they are a religious grouping who live in Palo Alto in California, and they're vegetarian, although when you look at it, they're perhaps not entirely strictly vegetarian. And they live as long as anybody. So, there's no evidence per se. I mean, if you have a very strict vegan diet, you clearly do lack essential vitamins and you need to take supplements. But my own personal view is that animal fats are healthy and we should be taking them. And if you don't eat them, you're less likely to be fully healthy. Because you've got to remember that when you look at groups like the, I'm saying they're Seventh-day Adventists, I've got this horrible feeling they're not, but I will say so for the moment, is that they have also a very healthy lifestyle in other ways. They don't smoke,
right.
They take lots of exercise, they have strong family bonds, et cetera. So there's no doubt that they do an awful lot of other things other than being vegetarian, because if you look at the other groupings around the world who live for a long time, they are not vegetarian. They eat meat and they have no problem with it.
Right.
So I have a tendency to view diet as being, so long as you eat enough vitamins and minerals and whatever, that it's not likely to do you harm.
Right. Okay, well, taking the saturated fats, I mean, these are mostly animal fats. Are there vegetables?
Yes, they are. Well, that is what. Unsaturated fats you tend to get from vegetable oils, usually, which most people get them from things like corn oil in the States, quite a lot of. Fish tend to have unsaturated fat, because saturated fat is, because technically every carbon atom is attached to two hydrogen atoms, which means that a chain, which they are, their fatty acids, a chain of carbon atoms, is relatively stiff. This is sort of
right.
Chemistry 101 is not totally accurate. Mm-hmm. But if you have an unsaturated fat, it means there's carbon atoms have a double bond, so they have a kind of break in them, which means they tend to be bendy, which means they tend to wobble about a bit, which means that at room temperature they're not solid, they're liquids, which means they're called oils.
Right.
And the reason that fish have oils is because if they were in the sea at 5 or 6 degrees, the saturated fat would get very stiff, so they wouldn't be able to swim. That's a very simplistic way of looking at it.
Oh, right. Well, that kind of makes sense.
That's how it works, yeah.
Whereas on land, warm-blooded animals will maintain a warm temperature.
So temperature, and if they had oils, we'd be rather floppy. So it's,
yeah, yes.
So nature has a way of creating things that work for us. So when the temperature is consistently cold in the sea, fish tend to have, and they can store it because also they're in the sea. It doesn't matter how they store it. But if an animal had liquid fat stores, we would struggle with that.
I mean, are there people who are suffering from not eating enough fat, or...
Are there people who suffer from not eating enough fat? Well, I'd rather tend to turn that one around and say, are there any people who suffer from eating too much fat? The answer is not that I can see anywhere. I mean, if you look at Eskimos, for example, no, I'm sorry, they're not Eskimos, I can't call them Eskimos.
Inuit.
I keep slipping back to my traditional thing. The Inuit, and also the Sami in Scandinavia, they have a very high fat diet, and quite often, in the Sami case, high saturated fat diet, and they have extraordinarily low rates of heart disease. Yeah, I mean, a fact that's been known for years and years and years.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, is there any evidence that eating too much fat, is there any evidence from anywhere that eating too much fat is damaging for you? The answer is no, and there never was. It was just an idea that somebody had, and it took over the world. And when you actually try and track it down, you just think, well, there must be some evidence from somewhere. Somebody surely has some evidence, and you just can't find it. And when I say this to people, they look at me as if, well, you're mad, because obviously there is evidence. There must be evidence.
Right.
It's true. And you say, well, just find it for me then. Show it to me. Bring it to me. Show it to me. And then I'll listen to you and I'll look at it. And I can't listen to people and look at it because it doesn't exist.
Yeah. It reminds me of the current debate over whether the Russians hacked the election, where nobody actually has any evidence, but it's like, trust us.
Well, I know. Well, I mean... It is. There is a strong element of. There's a very famous poem that may have heard of called "The Hunting of the Snark" by Lewis Carroll.
Yes.
Where after I say a thing three times, it is true. And that seems to be how an awful lot of science gets. It's funny because I do got a lot of tracking back. Where did the original fact come from?
Mm-hmm.
Where was this first stated? You know, if you go back to the five portions of fruit and vegetables, and you try and find where that came from. And it comes from nowhere. There is no evidence. There was no fact.
Just somebody just thought it was a good idea, so they put it in, and then somebody read it. Yes. Yeah.
You can't find the source evidence for it. You can't find the source evidence for almost all dietary stuff. I mean, there's data, but if you pull it back, there's people referencing each other backwards and forwards. And it's this paper said it, and that paper said it, and this paper said it, and this paper said it, that paper, this paper, and that paper said it. So we now have 50 reference sayings that it's true. You go, but where was the original research? You know, it's like, oh, well, I can't find it. Why can't I find it? Because it doesn't exist. And that's just it's a weird situation that people have huge faith in the science, and the science isn't there. Yeah.
And does fat make you fat?
Fat makes you thin, probably, which is another thing people have a huge problem with. It's just the idea that I do know as a chap in the UK who gives talks, and his comment is, it must be word association. If you eat fat, you get fat. Well, that's the only evidence that you can come across.
right, the word is
the same. The word fat. Well, the problem is that fat has become associated as a very negative thing, you know,
right.
Idea. So people look at fat and they go, ooh, you know, and then they think, oh, if you eat that, it must be bad for you. And clearly, if you eat that, it's going to make you fat, because it's the same stuff as fat in your body. I mean, it makes sense, I suppose, from a very superficial point of view, that if you eat fat, it's going to end up as fat. But if you understand anything about the human body works, that is just stupid. However, people believe that. There's one other idea, which is that fat, if you eat 10 grams of fat, it has twice as many calories as 10 grams of carbohydrate. Therefore,
right.
If you eat the same amount of fat as carbohydrate, you're eating twice as many calories, therefore you must become fat.
Right.
Well, you know, one, obviously, if that were true, that would be true, but people don't eat fat like that. As I say to someone, here's a half pound of butter. I will say to you, try and eat that.
Yes, yes.
And there's not many people could eat a half pound of butter without stopping halfway through and going off to be sick, probably.
Right.
I mean, you can't, it's much more difficult to overeat fat. Our body starts saying, hold on, I've had enough of this. Whereas with carbohydrates, I mean, you can sit, you can get a packet of what you call chips, we call crisps.
Right.
And you can eat and eat and eat and keep eating them, keep eating. Your body doesn't seem to say stop.
Right,
in the
right.
same way as it says stop when you're eating other things. It just keeps going. I mean, you can eat, you know. And people don't appear to be unaware, the body doesn't feed back the same way. So don't think there's any doubt that you will eat more carbohydrates more easily than the same amount of fat.
And just to be clear, if you eat carbohydrates, that can produce fat in your body?
Well, it will. I mean, as I say to people, you can... I don't know how large a Mars bar is in America. They seem to be getting smaller in Britain. I don't know if it's a good thing or not.
It's a cycle. They get smaller and smaller, and then somebody comes up with a new giant.
Jumbo Acme.
Right.
Super size.
And then they start the shrinking game again. Yeah.
But you can eat about three, I'm assuming an average world-size Mars bars. After you've eaten about three Mars bars, that's the entire amount of energy you can store as carbohydrate in your body. About 1,000 calories in your muscle and about 500 in your liver, stored as you know, as glycogen, which is a polymer of glucose, but then it stores it that way because otherwise it would have to have too much water around it. But, so that's it. So after you've eaten 1,500, and it's assuming you're not doing exercise, if you eat another calorie, then where does it go? Well, the answer is that it has to be converted in your liver to fat.
Mm.
And that's what your body does. And that is, therefore, the liver becomes a fat production, fat producing organ, and it sends out the fat in lipids around your body. Actually, it's called VLDLs, which, as you know, is another word for triglyceride, which some people may have heard of. So
right.
The body produces, the liver produces fat from glucose. It turns it into fat. It then is shoved into triglycerides, and it's sent around your body. It arrives at fat cells, and it's deposited in fat cells. And this process occurs, it's an automatic process, but of course it needs your insulin level to be quite high, because otherwise the liver doesn't turn into a lipid-producing organ. So you're producing lipids in your liver, it's going around the body, it's being dumped into cells, and if your carbohydrate consumption remains high, your blood sugar level will be high, your insulin will be driven high. And what this does is it turns the body into a fat storage machine, and it cannot escape.
And
so,
this ends up with diabetes if you take this too far?
Yeah, well it does. Obviously, I mean, there's other stage processes going on. But as I say to doctors when I'm having a discussion with them, I say there is a condition called lipodystrophy. It's actually called Bernardelli-Sieppe lipodystrophy, where you have no fat cells, and everyone goes, "Oh, that's fantastic, no fat cells." You
right.
Can't get fat. You cannot be fat if this condition, because you don't have any fat cells.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I ask them a question. I say, "How many people with this condition have type 2 diabetes?" And they all look at me and they say, "None." And I say, "The correct answer is they all have diabetes. Every single one
right.
has type 2 diabetes." And I say, "And if you can understand why that's the case, then you can starting to understand how all this works." The simple answer is, put it this way, if you can only store 1,500 calories of sugar or glucose as glycogen, once you've overridden that limit, and say you have no fat cells, so the liver starts producing fat, where does it go? Well, the answer is it has nowhere to go. And so the system backs up. So essentially, now people, the understanding, and this is simplifying it too much probably, I can see people who know the area groaning, is that you become diabetic if your fat storage system starts to back up,
mm-hmm.
isn't working. So it's actually people who are not very good at storing fat, who reach a limit of their fat storing, that become diabetic. And people reach that at different points.
Right.
So it's not, whilst it is, of course, it's too much energy and the inability of the body to store energy, it's not the becoming fat that actually makes you diabetic. It's the point where you can no longer become any fatter, and which is why people who have no fat cells become diabetic almost immediately.
Right.
Whereas some people you'll find who are hugely overweight, and you'll have seen them themselves and say, "No, my blood sugar's fine." And you think, well, how can that be? They're huge, you know. So it's the system of becoming diabetic. Yes, it is, of course, if you eat too much sugar, your insulin level will be high, it will drive fat production, it will drive it into your fat cells, but the point at which you become diabetic is the point at which your body starts going, "I ain't got anywhere else to put this, and I can't produce any more fat cells than you. Why would you worn me out, if you like?" But in the end, that is primarily due to eating carbohydrates. Yeah.
And is it generally true that a low-fat diet will be a high-carbohydrate diet?
Well, it has to be, in a way. There's not much else. Well,
there's protein,
fat,
I guess.
You can eat fat, you can eat protein, you can eat carbohydrates. There's nothing else you can eat.
Right.
Macronutrient. If you cut down on fat, well, there is some evidence that if you eat too much protein, this is not good. Your body doesn't like it.
Right.
So I don't know what the exact percentage is, and it varies from person to person. But people who've gone onto a very high protein, you know, like high protein, there was some evidence, I think it came from Canada, where trappers were eating like rabbits and beavers or something. I can't remember exactly what they ate, but it's very high protein and there's hardly any fat. And they
don't rabbits are like that. I think beavers have a lot of fat, actually.
Well, it might not be beavers then, but there was somewhere in, I think they found in Canada that certain people were really struggling because they were eating a very high protein, low fat, low carbohydrate diet, and the liver just doesn't like it.
But in the modern world where you're buying food at the supermarket, probably not rabbits.
You'll be, if you're not eating fat, you'll be eating carbohydrate. And of course, the switch has happened. Because when you eat a low-fat yogurt or a low-fat anything, in order to make it taste of anything, you have to fill it up with sugar.
Right.
So if you take fat out of a yogurt, how are you making it taste of something? You put sugar into it.
Right.
And that's just what happens. So, yes, the switch has happened. And you can see that from the dietary, intake around the world, is that people have reduced fat intake. Carbohydrate intake has gone up. People have done what they've been advised to do. And as you know yourself, since that advice came out, the levels of overweight and obesity and diabetes have just skyrocketed.
Right.
And there's a clear cause and effect going on here. We have caused, the medical profession, by getting the information completely wrong, have created an epidemic of obesity and diabetes and ill health from all of this, and are unwilling, for reasons of all sorts of reasons, to admit they've got it wrong. And they are, you could be alarmist about this and say that I think, there's a potential, if you looked at it and actually added it all together, we're causing thousands, probably millions, maybe tens of millions of people to be getting a high level of morbidity and early mortality. I think this is the most damaging and dangerous piece of advice that comes out of the medical profession. And it's wrong, and it's damaging, and you can confront them with all of the information and evidence that is wrong, and they just say it's right. They're just jammed up. They can't get out of it.
But I sense that things are changing. Like, there was a recent article, I can't remember where it was, in a fairly major journal, I don't know, Scientific American or somewhere, saying that the early evidence from the 1950s about the low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet being beneficial was pretty much fraudulent, and it was the sugar industry that was pushing, let's focus on fat.
There was Harvard researchers in the early 60s, late 50s, who working with the sugar industry, produced a report saying fat causes heart disease, it's got nothing to do with sugar.
Right.
And they no one admitted it, but the chain of letters makes it very clear. They were paid to say it.
Right.
That's the kind of things that were going on. I mean, if you look at Ansel Keys, who was, many people consider, the godfather of the whole diet-heart hypothesis, he ran an experiment called the Minnesota Coronary Experiment in the late 60s, early 70s, which replaced saturated fat with polyunsaturated fats in the diet. This is the largest study that's ever been done in this area. And the results were never published. They were found. The actual data was found and was published in the British Medical Journal about 6 months ago.
Wow.
And they found that when they re-reviewed the data, that the impact of reducing saturated fat and replacing it with polyunsaturated fat was to have no effect on heart disease, but increased the rate of death, overall mortality, by nearly 30% for every 10% drop in the cholesterol level. So actually what they found was that the cholesterol level fell, and the mortality rate shot up.
Well, let's go on and talk about statins then, because isn't the purpose of statins, or statins, statins, isn't the purpose to reduce cholesterol levels?
Well, of course, that's what they do, and they do it very well.
Therefore reduce heart disease, right?
Well, and therefore, you see, the complication here is I point people to a recent study on a drug that you'll never hear of and will never be heard of again, called evacetrapib. Was designed to raise high-density lipoprotein, which is the good cholesterol, and lower low-density protein, lipoprotein, which is the bad cholesterol, and it did that very effectively. It lowered the LDL, the low-density bad cholesterol, by 37%, which is more than statins can do. And it raised the high-density lipoprotein by 130%. And it had absolutely and precisely no impact on heart disease whatsoever. Previous drugs in the same class had actually increased the risk of heart disease. So, yes, statins lower cholesterol, statins reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease by an amount that I consider vanishingly small.
Right.
But the evidence I consider very clear is that any benefit they have is through effects that have nothing to do with lowering the cholesterol level. I know people can sort of raise their eyebrows and say, oh, this is a very, sounds like a very sophisticated argument.
That's right. Right.
There's an enormous amount of evidence that other drugs that lower cholesterol have had no effect. Other interventions that lower cholesterol have had no effect. Statins
right.
are the only drugs that have been found to have any effect. So clearly they must be operating through some other process.
Right.
And
that
when
makes
you
sense.
Look at it, they have many other mechanisms by which they operate, any or all of which could potentially have some impact on the risk of heart disease. So I think the problem is that they completely mesmerized everyone into, you know, we gave people statins, they lowered the cholesterol level, and that rate of heart disease dropped a bit. To tell you how much of an a bit, I won't go down that route at the moment. But what they also do is they're anticoagulant. Statins have an anticoagulant effect.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, about the same as aspirin. And they have about the same effect on heart disease as aspirin. So, in my opinion, the evidence as it exists, you know, another thing I ask cardiologists when I speak to them is saying, there's never been any evidence that cholesterol, raised cholesterol, has any association with stroke, causal or just an association. And yet, if you give statins, they reduce the risk of stroke by the same amount as they reduce the risk of heart disease. So how can reducing something that is not a risk factor have any effect on a disease unless it's operating through a different mechanism?
Right.
They never answer that question.
Yes.
They still answer that question.
And do statins have adverse effects?
I think they have enormous adverse effects. It's one of my big problems. I mean, I'm very anti-statin, and I've written anti-statin stuff, and I've been part of clinical papers that are anti-statin, primarily because I believe that the adverse effects that they cause, in some cases, are permanent, irreversible, and very damaging.
Like rhabdomyolysis?
Sorry?
Like
rhabdomyolysis is an obvious one, but it's pretty rare.
Okay.
But I'm talking about neuropathy, damage to nerves.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about potentially accelerating Alzheimer's. I'm talking about things that are really quite damaging, and muscle damage that doesn't repair. If taking a statin gave you a headache, and when you stopped taking a statin, your headache went away, I'd say, well, I'm not really that bothered. I mean, that's not a major problem.
Right.
But if they're causing problems that are potentially permanent and crippling, then that changes the equation enormously. And I do believe, I've spoken to so many people, I mean, as you can imagine, because of what I write and everything, I get these people writing to me saying, you know, I took statins and I couldn't walk, and then I couldn't walk and then end up in hospital. And everyone said it was nothing to do with the statin, and now I've stopped taking it. I have recovered a bit, but I'm still not back to where I was.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, when I have heart-rending stories of people writing to me saying, my husband was put on statins, he was a happy, you know, energetic guy, and he's now crippled and can't get out of a wheelchair. You know, okay, you can say anecdotes are anecdotes, and, you know, the reality, though, is that when people have looked at this in studies, they find really high levels of people having adverse effects. Some people have no adverse effects, there's no doubt about that. Well, at least there seems to be no doubt about that. But, I mean, you're giving a drug to people lifelong, which reduces the risk by, I mean, the statistics, unfortunately, are presented in such a way that, you know, you can never understand them.
Right.
But even if you say take the most positive statistics, that one, if you took a statin, you'd have to have about 300 people taking a statin for 5 years for one event, not necessarily fatal, to be delayed. Because they use the word prevent, but we're not, that's the wrong word, right? We're talking about delaying things, we're not talking about preventing things.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, all you need is 5% of people to have an unpleasant side effect. And you're talking an overwhelming burden of harm versus benefit.
Right.
And people, I get people speak to me, they say, oh, my doctor said I mustn't stop taking them or I'll die immediately of a heart attack.
It's
just ridiculous, you know. And people say, well, if you don't take statins, I'm not going to treat you any longer as a doctor. What are you talking about? Did you ever read the Geneva Convention on Hippocratic Oath? I mean, what are you doing, guys? You know, someone's getting really nasty adverse effects.
I've heard that quite a bit about if you do something I don't like as a doctor, you're not going to be my patient anymore.
Yeah, well, have you heard that, yeah?
Yeah, in other cases.
Well, that's just rubbish. I mean, you shouldn't be a doctor if you say that. Your job as a doctor is to say, right, well, that's fine. I'd prefer you did if you believe that. But we'll see what we can do that is beneficial for you, you know, in the meantime. You know, it's like saying if you don't stop smoking, I won't treat you. If you're obese, I won't treat you. You know, if you wear that jumper, I'm not going to treat you. I mean, you know, it's like your job as a doctor to be judgmental. You know, you can try and convince someone. If you don't, you just say, fine, let's get on with it.
Right. You can give advice. I mean, I thought that's what doctors are supposed to be. Here's my advice about what you should do.
Well, that is what doctors do. I mean, some doctors seem to think they should be doing, I don't know what they think they should be doing, but they shouldn't be doing that. You know, I have plenty of people who keep taking statins, and I say, if I was you, I'd stop. I say, well, if you don't want to stop, it's up to you, you know. You know, I'm not going to force you to stop taking statins. That's not my job. My job is to say, here's what I think, here's the evidence. It's your decision. It's your health. It's your body, you know.
Well, let's go through some of those other things. I previously interviewed Dr. Peter Gotch, who I'm sure you're familiar with.
Peter Gotch is, not quite sure how you pronounce his name yet, but...
Neither am I.
I certainly can't spell it. He's a great man. I really appreciate and admire what he does, you know.
Mm-hmm. So mammograms,
in fact, I'm just looking at a book called Mammography Screening by Peter D. Gutch.
Yes.
Who started looking at mammography with a completely open mind, as far as I can see.
Yeah.
No ideas one way or the other. In fact, I believe the Danish government asked him to have a look at it, just to sort of get all the evidence together and present it more appropriately.
Right.
And as he started looking through it, he thought, you know what, I don't think there's any benefit to this.
Right.
In fact, I think there might be more harm than benefit.
But there's a big benefit to the medical industry, because mammography drives up the number of interventions.
Well, yes, hugely. I mean, you know, everyone says it's all about money, don't they? And of course, when you come to things like screening and statins and all this, there's vast, vast sums of money.
Right.
And therefore, there's an enormous pressure from a direction that probably shouldn't be there. But, for mammography, I mean, how much is spent on mammography in the US every year? I don't know. In the UK, it's hundreds of millions, billions. More interventions, more operations, more treatment, more medication. It's just huge. And people, when I start, if I do criticize it, they go, well, you just don't believe in anything, do you? And I go, well, so don't use that argument. That's just annoying. But I believe in trying to do the best possible thing for people. And if the evidence supports not doing it, then don't do it.
Do you think there's a deep sort of innate human belief that doing something is better than doing nothing?
And oh, absolutely.
So a mammogram is like, how can it hurt to try to find, the things earlier? How can that possibly...
How can that be? Yeah, how can you object to that? Hold on. Give me half an hour, and I'll tell you how I object to it. Because, yes, I think there's the... I think it's this doing things. Doing, you must do things. My motto has become... Don't just do something, stand there, you know.
Yes.
Because you can't stop doctors doing things. You know, they must do something. I mean, when they have, like, prostate cancer, they don't say, well, we're not going to operate on you, and we're not going to do anything, we're just going to see how it goes. They call it watchful waiting, as if they're kind of sitting there poised at any minute just to jump forward.
Right. You know, like a vulture.
Like having a power. I say I'm going to have a snooze. Everyone else says it's a power nap, as if it's a positive thing, you know.
Yes.
But doctors, it's the hardest thing for them is to say, you know what, I don't think it's going to do any good, so we're not going to do it. I'll have a personal situation, something where I don't think an investigation should be being done. But trying to tell the doctors, don't do it, you know. You can just see them itching to get the scanners and screeners and everything out. You're going, well, if it's not going to change the management, why are you doing it?
Well, isn't it also, I think, especially with the PSA test, if they say, and maybe with a subsequent biopsy, if they say you have a cancer,
yes.
Then people will say, or the same with mammography, get it out, right?
Oh, of course they will, yeah. Oh, it's the same problem that, I've just forgotten his name, but it will come to me, when they started doing angiograms, and then they could see a blockage in the left anterior descending artery in the heart, which is what they used to call the widow maker, you know, when you're about to die of a heart attack. You know, if you say to somebody, you've got a widow maker in there, they go, what are they going to say to that? Yeah. Oh, I think you should just leave it, you know.
Right.
They're going to go, I want that out of there. I want that story. I want a triple artery bypass, and I want it now. So when he tried to do the research into is it you know, better to do the operation or not do the operation, of course, he couldn't find anyone who didn't want the operation.
Right.
So you have that problem, you know. No one says they get a lump in the breast. No woman's going to go, oh, well, it's probably not going to do anything. It's probably just a little lump and it won't grow. Yeah, I tell you what, let's just leave it there.
Well, when I was talking to Peter Gotti, actually, I asked him, you know, what do you call, I think it's called in breast cancer, in situ ductal carcinoma, which is a tumor that's not going to grow. And I said, what's the word for a tumor that's not cancerous? And he said, well, there is no separate word.
Yes.
So it's very hard to express to people that this is a lump, and it's just a lump, and it's probably not going to go anywhere.
Ductal carcinoma in situ, DCIS, yeah.
Right.
And I think the answer is you're probably best not to disturb it, because it might just be sitting there going, dum-de-dum, stick a needle in it.
Right, and then it might...
Oh, what the hell is that? It's about time I decided to grow.
Right.
There is potentially an evidence that you start messing around with these things and they become active on you. But again, the problem is that how do you know for sure? You're never, how are you going to do a study where you get 100,000 women and say, we're just going to leave it for you, another 100,000 and say, we're going to operate for you? Because you're never going to get anyone to agree to not take it out.
Right.
You know? And so you have, it just becomes so difficult when you've got everybody gets a scan, everybody gets operated on. Where's your control groups? You know, it's very difficult. You know, they never should have started all this scanning and screening without doing the studies first, but they did.
Right.
And then you're stuck, you know, because you cannot get a control group organized.
And you agree with both mammograms and PSA that the screening does not result in lowering the death rate?
Well, the evidence, such as I can see it, says that basically they are a complete waste of time. I wouldn't worry about that. Okay, you want to spend hundreds of millions on it and nothing happens. But I think that it's the false positives, the false negatives, the fear, the anxiety, that we are, my review of the evidence is we may well be doing more harm than good, and that's what Peter Gotti thinks. He's a much brighter man than me, and he's looked at the data in much more detail than me. I think I tend to agree with him. I did write about this before he started writing about this years ago, saying mammography screening doesn't seem to be effective. You know, you really are then up against a particularly vehement and difficult group of people who just will have a go at you. You know, they don't want to discuss the evidence. They just want to say, you just want millions of women to die of breast cancer.
Right.
And stuff like this.
Right.
You know, yes, of course I do. I would put on earth in order to make sure more women died of breast cancer or more men died of prostate cancer. That's actually my motivation as a doctor. Yeah, really, honestly, that's what you think I want to do? No. I want people to have healthy lives free of fear and concern. I want them to do things that really work, and I want them to not worry about things all the time when really, you know, we shouldn't be doing this. It begins to bug me continuously.
Right. You know, well, speaking of breast cancer and prostate cancer, you wrote on your website that sunshine reduces the risk of both of those,
yes,
while increasing the risk of skin cancer. So, and also sunshine produces vitamin D. So, what should people do? Should they
go out in the sun? Is what they should do.
Get some sun, but not get sunburned.
Well, you may not get sunburned. I mean, the evidence for sunburning causing cancer is extremely weak.
Right.
It's one of these. Well, you know, I mean, the idea that you get sunburned when you're 5 and you get malignant melanoma when you're 45. The evidence for that is, I mean, it's like saying you smoke one cigarette when you're 10 and you get lung cancer when you're 60.
Right.
The evidence that you stop smoking, the risk goes down very rapidly. This is what you call confirmation bias. You know, you say to someone who's got skin cancer, oh, did you used to get burned a lot when you were a child? They go, oh, yeah, I did, you know, because they're trying to look for an explanation as well. I mean, if you want research to be absolutely meaningless, that's meaningless research.
Right.
Burning your skin, yes, fine. It's painful, and it clearly is not good for you to do that because it ruined your holiday for starters.
Right.
The evidence that it actually causes skin cancer, nasty skin cancer, doesn't exist in my opinion. Not to any degree you could possibly sustain it.
Right.
There's no doubt that if you're fair-skinned and you live in if you're light-skinned and you live in somewhere like Australia or southern states of America, and you spend just ages and ages out in the sun, your chances of getting things like actinic keratosis, basal cell carcinoma, rodent ulcers, is increased. There's no doubt that's true. But these are, if you're going to get cancer, that's the cancer to get, because you can spot it, you can treat it, you can get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a good thing to get. But the upside of skin of sunshine is it increases vitamin D, you know, it increases nitric oxide, which I think is probably more important. It increases all sorts of things that we probably don't even know yet.
Right.
It definitely reduces the risk of major and serious cancers, such as breast, colorectal, and prostate.
Right.
And probably all the others too. Because vitamin D is an anti-cancer agent. We know that, and you can show it.
And one thing that's always concerned me is that the skin is actually very good at absorbing chemicals. I know reading a couple stories about men who stuck their arms in a vat of pesticides to retrieve a tool and died the next day because they absorbed a toxic dose of pesticides. What about sunscreen, the chemicals in sunscreen that are in contact with your skin for long periods of time?
Well, I think this is an unknown, isn't it? I think sticking chemicals, active chemicals on your body, all over your skin, that are potentially powerful, is something you've got to be pretty careful about. I know there are some people, I haven't looked at the research in this area in any huge detail, but there are a lot of people who believe that it's actually the application of sunscreen that and the damage that causes that's more likely to be the problem.
And of course, applying sunscreen is correlated with spending more time in the sun these days. So, therefore, you could look at it as sunshine causing these problems, but it's actually the sunscreen. It'd be hard to separate those two things out.
Yes, and I think that's why I kind of have never really gone down that route very strongly, because I just don't see how you can tease out one from the other. I'm not sure. What, you know, I say to people in the United Kingdom, the evidence is strong that the two groups of people in Britain who get the least malignant melanoma are farmers and construction workers. And these are the two groups of people who spend the longest time outside in the sun.
Interesting.
So, and the other thing we know about malignant melanoma is that some of the most common places for them is places where the sun doesn't shine, particularly. I mean, you can get malignant melanoma in the. There's a friend of mine, her mother died, she got malignant melanoma of the lining of her nose inside.
Right.
I said, well, it's hard to see that was. You can get malignant melanoma in the esophagus. You can get malignant melanoma in the vagina.
Right.
I'm finding it hard to see how you can get too much sun exposure in those areas.
Right, certainly.
If you're using Virchow's triad, you know, is the active agent causing the disease, is it sufficient or necessary? Well, when it comes to malignant melanoma, it's neither, is it? You don't need it at all, and you can still get it, which suggests it can only be a minor factor. And in fact, such evidence as I've seen is that the people who've had malignant melanoma and then had it taken away, the ones who've had most sun exposure following that are the ones least likely to get recurrence.
Huh, interesting.
So, you know, the data, the problem here is the data is messed up as well, because people put all skin cancers together in one big thing and then say, oh, skin cancer is increased by sun exposure. Well, it's true, but it depends what you call cancer. So, I mean, I don't know the statistics for the States, but it'd be similar to here. Each year in Britain, 2,000 people die of skin cancer, mm-hmm. malignant melanoma, which is really not a lot of people compared to the number of people, of 70 million people in Britain. If you look at breast cancer, it's about 20,000. If you look at prostate cancer, it's about 20,000. If you look at colorectal cancer, it's about 30,000. You know, if you can reduce those by, you know, if you reduce those by 50%, which some papers suggest you can, then we're reducing, you know, cancer deaths by 70 or 80,000 a year.
Which is much more than the total number of skin cancer deaths today.
If you double malignant melanoma,
right,
there'll be another 2,000. So you reduce by 70,000, you increase by 2,000.
You're still ahead, yeah.
You are ahead.
The math's not that difficult on that one.
Well, the math's very simple in that one, and that's the math. And if it reduces the chances of multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, in fact, all neurological diseases and cardiovascular disease, which it does, and it's been evidenced that it does, then this is just a no-brainer. You know, why would you risk not going in the sun when that's going to increase your risk of dying of heart disease, neurological disorders, and almost all forms of cancer?
Right.
In order to prevent one form of cancer that's very unlikely to get you anyway. It's like an equation that is stacked, you know, 90 to 1 in one direction.
Yes,
and yet
yes.
Somehow we've convinced everyone to stay out of the sun.
Right.
It's just bonkers.
Controversial intervention for young people, especially girls these days, is the HPV vaccine. Do you have any opinions on that?
I've looked at it. Vaccination has become the great area that you cannot criticize in any way, or you will be absolutely pinned to the ground
right. And
obliterated. So I tend to remain relatively quiet about vaccination.
You have enough on your plate.
It's just to be frank, you know, if I took on vaccination, then would you say, oh, you just don't believe in anything, you just criticize everything. You know,
right.
It makes it very much more easy for me to be dismissed. I'm trying to remain in the kind of take me seriously camp without just being said, oh, this guy's just an absolute idiot. He doesn't just attack everything. You know, he's a complete fool and oh, he doesn't even believe in vaccination. As I say, I believe that vaccination has been very effective in some diseases. I believe that we're over-vaccinating now and potentially causing some damage to people. And HPV is one vaccine that I think is potentially taking a step too far in you know, the harm-to-benefit equation.
Yes, thanks for that opinion. As a doctor who doesn't believe in a lot of things doctors believe in, like, what do you spend your time doing if you're not telling people to get mammograms and PSAs and take statins? Is there still a role for doctors after you take all those things away?
For doctors. There's all sorts of things we should be doing, you know. I mean, at the moment, I'm focusing myself my time in looking at elderly people who've fallen and fractured legs, and we're trying to get them back into the community.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing physio, and we're doing community stuff, and we're doing a lot of work with them to... In fact, I do a lot of work with them to try and make sure that they are as well as possible and operating as well as possible in the community. I mean, in some cases, that means looking at the medications and saying, let's stop all of these things.
Right.
My problem is they go back to their own primary physician and then put them straight back on them all again.
Right.
But at least I'm trying to make some impact on... I think it's, we are over-medicating people.
Mm-hmm.
We are giving too much medicine to people. The life expectancy in the States has just gone down, I notice. The life
right.
expectancy of over 65s in the UK, if you take someone at 65, how much longer they're going to live, it's recently gone down. I don't think these things are coincidence. I think we are giving people far too much medicine. I deal with people who've fallen, elderly people, about 80 years of age, around about that age, in one of my roles. And the average number of medications that they're taking currently stands at 12, and that's 12 different drugs, some of which will be taken three times a day. And I just look at them and I think, if I took this, I think I would probably never get out of my bed again.
Well, I wonder how much Alzheimer's is really just people who are so over-medicated.
We can wonder, but people have become so browbeaten, and doctors too, you must treat this, you must treat that, you must get the blood pressure down to this, you must get the cholesterol to that, you must... And I think we're just burdening people with an enormous amount of chemicals inside their bodies. So, you know, what's left? Well, there's plenty of things doctors can do. There's millions of things doctors can do. But my focus is supposed to become more of trying to push back against I'd call it too much medicine, too much. Stop doing so many of these things. Stop these interventions. Stop trying to think you've got absolute control over people's health.
Right.
You know, we don't. We would be much better leaving people alone to live natural lives. Stop telling people to eat this and don't eat that. What's been the effect of that? It's horribly negative, you know?
Yes.
You know, we are potentially, modern medicine is a fantastic and brilliant thing that the humans have achieved. You know, my father had a heart valve operation. You know, I had appendicitis, I got operated on. I mean, that's just amazing skills. And,
right.
But when the world of kind of this, what they call preventative medicine, I think we've just got it horribly wrong.
It's kind of a contradiction in terms. I don't think prevention involves medicine.
Well, no, I don't think it does either.
Yes.
But, you know, we're kind of stuck, I'm afraid, with this. I hate the word paradigm, but I think it is a paradigm which seems to be, you know, ingrained more heavily in it. I suppose it's just feeling that part of my job is to try and fight against that, really.
Yes. Well, we've also come to the end of our time together. We've been talking for almost an hour, and it's been a very interesting discussion. And I think the information is very valuable. So thank you.
I think, as a wise man said, the world changes one conversation at a time. And hopefully the more conversations people can have, then they can at least get a bit more information that they find useful to them, yeah.
Yes. Well, I will send you a link to the show when it goes up in a few days. So that you can distribute it to people if you like, or put it on your website.
Well, I'll probably stick it on my blog and say people can have a listen if they want to. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much for joining me today, and have a good evening.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to episode 128 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Or follow us on Twitter @InfectiousMyth. Until next week, goodbye.